Wisp Sports Radio, the voice of women in sport.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is season 2, episode 3. Listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with Wisp Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center. In this podcast, I am going to talk to Professor Mary Jo Kane, who is the founder and first director of the Tucker Center and was also featured in Season 1, Episode 2. In that episode, Professor Kane and I talked about her groundbreaking research and seminal paper that argued for sport performance as a continuum rather than a binary. And if you haven't listened to that episode, I really would encourage you to do so. Because also in that podcast, Professor Kane and I talked about how the sport continuum theory may be applied to the current topic of and debate surrounding the inclusion of transgender athletes. So Dr. Kane's sport continuum theory paper that was published in the mid-90s was really groundbreaking, but she also has another line of inquiry around portrayals of women in the sport media and research that helps us answer the critical million-dollar question, does sex sell women's sport? Welcome back, Professor Kane.
Thank you, and I am delighted to be here, Dr. Lavoie.
So first, for those listeners who may not be familiar with the sport media research and particularly your line of inquiry around this topic, why do sport media portrayals matter of women's sport and female athletes? Why should we care?
Well, there is the old adage of, if you can't see it, and literally and figuratively in terms of media images, you cannot be it. And it's not just images in sports, but just images in general. The culture is enormously impacted by and reflected in the kinds of images, media images in particular, that are created. And over the years, in terms of how female athletes have been represented in the media, it has been the case that they are much more likely to be presented off the court, out of uniform, and in sexy babe poses. And that has long given the message to the culture and to female athletes themselves that they are first and foremost thought of in terms of how pretty they are and how sexy they are, rather than how athletically competent they are. And that matters a lot.
Yes, and I think it also matters because when young women see these continual sexualized images of female athletes, their role models, their heroines, that it also tells them that their bodies are objects to be consumed, which can lead to eating disorders and anxiety and depression and a lot of psychosocial outcomes for young girls that we don't want, specifically when they consume images of sexualized female athletes. So there's a lot of reasons why it matters, but I have to ask the question because you know as well as I, people ask us the question, why should we care if female athletes are sexualized? What is the big deal?
Yeah, well, one of the big deals is if you are taught that young women or women in general don't possess certain physical and physiological capacities and that that's a function of their biology, and this, you know, that male superiority in sport isn't a function of some backroom cigar smoking sexist gender inequity, that it's just biology, and it's not, you know, don't talk to us, talk to God about the fact that females just simply don't possess certain physiological and biological capacities. So then what happens when we actually see a female who crushes a softball, or who is very physically strong and powerful, that absolutely can change and fundamentally alter how we see female athletes and then females in general. And we might think, oh my God, they really are strong, they really are powerful. And so one way to contain that power, which actually is inherent because women are strong and powerful, is to create images that focus not on their athletic competence, but on their femininity and sexuality. And as a result, the status quo of male superiority is maintained. So those media images mean a great deal. And it's again, for me, it always comes back to who benefits from images of female athletes as sexy babes versus highly competent athletes. And I would argue it's not female athletes.
I think that is clear. But when we frame it that way about why is it that female athletes are routinely asked to be portrayed in sexualized ways is one question. But you have also pushed us to think about this idea of power and who benefits when the dominant images are sexualized and pretty and feminine and heterosexy. So you mentioned this idea of how female athletes are dominantly portrayed. So for the listeners that are unfamiliar with this idea of how the portrayals of female athletes show up in the media, but also the quantity of how often we see female athletes, just give the listeners a short recap on what we know about the quantity versus the quality of images.
Well, one of the things that's been extraordinary about my line of research, which I, another way to think about this is sport, media, and gender. And within the field of sports sociologists, how female athletes or media images of female athletes is one of the most studied areas within our academic field. And what's been remarkable about this research is that 40 to 50 years in, we have an amazing consistency, or what I call a universality of results, meaning it hasn't mattered much whether sport media scholars like myself have looked at broadcast journalism or print journalism or new media or the internet, social media. What we find is that female athletes, first of all, are significantly underrepresented in terms of amount of coverage. So for example, even though female athletes represent about 40% of all sport participants nationwide, and also when you look at Division I scholarships, females are rewarded or awarded 43% of all Division I scholarships. And yet the most recent research indicates that in terms of amount of coverage, they still only receive 4-6% across the vast, ubiquitous sport media landscape. So that's one thing. So it's not just that female athletes are underrepresented, it's that their lack of coverage is a false representation of how much female athletes really are engaged in the sporting enterprise. So that suppresses knowledge that female athletes are enormously, that there's a huge critical mass and body of female athletes, and that females are deeply engaged in sports.
And it doesn't represent reality, I think, is what you're saying.
Correct. It's a denial of reality. It's not just that they're underrepresented because nobody's interested, which we can get to later, but it's a denial of the actual participation rates by a country mile. So, for example, I'm not saying, okay, 40% of all sport participants are female and they represent 25%. But when you have 40% and 4%, that's a pretty dramatic difference. Now, in terms of type of coverage, what we have seen, although I do want to emphasize on a more positive note, that there has been a dramatic shift over the last, I would say, two decades. But historically, traditionally, female athletes are significantly more likely than male athletes to be portrayed off the court, out of uniform, and in highly sexualized or what I call sexy babe images. And again, this doesn't highlight or emphasize how incredibly gifted these women are, how incredibly powerful they are. Now, over the last, as I just said, two decades, and I would say maybe even the last decade, and you can see this in terms of now how the WNBA represents itself, how ESPN, when it covers the WNBA, portray female athletes. We saw this big time in the Women's World Cup this last summer. Finally, media images and media narratives are starting to reflect the reality of women's sports participation, meaning the focus has been on their athleticism, their mental toughness, their training, their strategy, their skill.
Their rivalries,
and that has been a dramatic, dramatic shift. And I have to say, she said humbly, that one of the reasons for that shift is the research that we've done and then have disseminated to a lot of the gatekeepers and the decision makers, so that now those who produce sports, women's sports, see that it is in their interest to portray female athletes as highly competent.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple points I want to piggyback on, Professor Kane, is one, when we're talking about the quantity of media coverage, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that some of our other sports sociology colleagues, Cheryl Cookie, Mike Messner, Margaret Carlisle Duncan, have also found similar results in their gender and televised sport media research. And I know that Dr. Cookie is currently looking at the next data collection, and I will be really interested to see if that percentage has gone up or down or stayed the same with this next iteration of her data. And then to the point about the realistic portrayals of the Women's World Cup team as dominant and feisty competitors and highly talented and crushing their opponents, which was great because that's what was happening, but then they also got a lot of criticism for being portrayed in the realistic ways of their athleticism. So it's almost like you can't win. Either you don't see them or you see them as they are, and then they get crushed by the critics. So, I mean, can't win. What do you have to think about that?
Yeah, I think you could make that argument. That said, I was very delighted and even heartened to see that those young women, who are really the second generation of the fruits of Title IX, when they were criticized, they didn't apologize. They didn't change their behavior. If anything, they trolled their critics and they came back even stronger. And I have emphasized this point a lot. What was most important at the end of the day is they won. They put a target on their back and they said, bring it on. And they won. And had they not won, we would be having a very different conversation. But I think that those women are different, and I've been asked this question too, Dr. Lavoy, are different from the 99ers, meaning the women who won the World Cup, Mia Hamm, Brandi Chastain, and those women who were, and I'm not in any way criticizing them because this is 20 years ago, but they were, I think, much more perhaps media conscious or grateful that they got the coverage that they did get at the time. Whereas one of the things that has happened as I believe a direct result of Title IX is that for the first time in our country, we have a whole generation of young women who grow up with a sense of entitlement to sports. And they believe and they act as if they belong and they deserve it just as much as their male counterparts do. And it was that kind of attitude of entitlement, I think, that absolutely was behind their reaction, meaning Rapinoe and others who said, we're not going to apologize. This is how men act, and we can act however we want to act as long as we win. And by the way, they did.
And what's interesting about that is just a couple days ago, I was on the phone with Jill Ellis, the Women's World Cup team, and she was asking me if I knew of data that supported the fact that the reason why elite female athletes, what are the motivations for why elite female athletes play? And to my knowledge, and if anyone listening knows the answer to this or knows of that data, please let me know. Because we always ask kids why they play, right? That's well known, you know, and winning ranks low in the pecking order for boys and girls. But it dawned on me when she asked me that, we don't ask elite women why they play sports. And I think what we'd find is that they want to win.
They want to win. Absolutely.
The Women's World Cup team isn't playing for their health and for physical activity and to make friends. They want to dominate and win.
Yes. And again, I think the difference between this generation of elite female athletes and the 99ers, meaning two decades ago, is that, and I obviously don't want to speak for them, but their attitude is not one of, well, we're just grateful for the opportunity. It's they've grown up with the opportunity, and now let's take it to the next level. And why are we motivated? Because we want to be champions, because we want to push ourselves to and be the best that we can be.
And not apologize for doing
so. And not apologize for being elite athletes and not apologizing for dominating and destroying our opponents, because that's why we play the game. We play to win. And I, for one, couldn't be more delighted that that's their attitude.
Okay, so let's talk about the media's, back to the media's role in constructing these narratives around female athletes. One of your early media studies looked at the cover images of collegiate media guides for athletics and looked at the pictures on the front of the guide. And you did this with a colleague of ours, Dr. Joe Bicey. And you compared the covers of the men's sport media guides and the covers of the women's sport media guides. And tell us what the key takeaway is of this study.
Well, the first thing to say is that the reason that Dr. Bicey and I, who was my first PhD student here at the University of Minnesota, the reason that we looked at media guides, and this is going to seem like an anachronism because I don't even think Division I schools even put out media guides anymore.
Well, they're digital now, so there's no hard copy.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Okay, right. So what was important in those days is that media guides and media guide covers in particular were very consciously constructed images of how a university, an athletic department, and a particular sport wanted to portray their athletes in that particular sport in that particular year. So again, it was consciously constructed. And the reason they were called media guides is that these guides were sent out to members of the media to say, this is who we are, this is what we stand for, and here, media, use this guide in these covers to help frame this media story. The other reason that media guides were important is because these were the guides that were sent to recruits and their parents. And so the key takeaway here is that these images are consciously constructed narratives and images of how that particular sport wanted to portray itself writ large. And so what Dr. Bicey and I did is we looked at all Division I sports programs in the country in the Big Five conferences. It wasn't called the Big Five then, but the Power Five, right? The ACC, the SEC, the Big 12, the Pac-12, the Big 10, and yep. I'm
the big of the big,
but you get the point. The big of the big. And the reason that we wanted to look at Division I media guide covers and media images is because they tended to set the tone for the rest of intercollegiate athletics, meaning Division III would often copy what Division I was doing. So what we wanted to do is say, okay, within Division I athletics, where we looked at every single sport of every single university within every single Power Five conference, and we asked, and we said, in the same sport, in the same school, in the same year, how were men's and women's sports portrayed? So how were the women's gymnastics team versus the men's gymnastics team, the golf team, men's golf versus women's golf? You didn't have a comparison with football. I guess the volleyball would be the closest comparison, for example. And we just looked at how was it that male versus female athletes were portrayed on these covers? And meaning, were they in uniform, in action, or were they posed and off the court? And what we found, and by the way, this was a longitudinal study that was replicated several times, that female athletes, big surprise, were significantly more likely than male athletes to be portrayed off the cover, out of uniform, in passive poses, often in very not sexy babe pornography, because we're talking about colleges and universities, right? But in prom dresses. And one of the things that I would often share with my students in classes is if I took away the words University of Tennessee track team and you just looked at the image, you would think that it was a pic. And I said to the students, who is this picture of? What group of individuals do these women, or what organization or group do these women represent? And they're going to say a sorority, for example, because there is nothing in the image that lets you know that not only are these women female athletes, but they are elite Division I female athletes. And yet schools went to great pains to not let you know that these were female athletes.
Some of these covers, and I wish, you know, we could flash to a video screen for the listeners, because some of these historic media guide cover images are laughable. I mean, they're in a limousine and the coach has a tuxedo on. They're sitting on the veranda sipping tea. There are angels in a cloud. I mean, there are some, Pat Summitt is a pirate with an eye patch on. I mean, it's just amazingly, I don't even have words for it.
Playboy bunnies in one, a classic infamous one. Yeah, and I think the thing that's important to stress here is that what's important is when female athletes were not portrayed as athletes, how were they portrayed? So, for example, if you have a media guide cover and you want to emphasize to the media and to recruits and their parents what you care about as an institution and as a particular sport team, you could have an image of these female athletes in the library or going to a children's hospital and visiting young kids who are recovering from cancer or undergoing cancer treatment.
Sitting in class.
So being students in class. But what was critical is that when these female athletes were not portrayed as athletes, 99 times out of 100, they were portrayed as pretty and feminine and sexy. And that was not a random occurrence. And that is the key takeaway.
Yeah. And it's for the listeners to this podcast, we have a 25-year longitudinal analysis report that Dr. Bicey and Dr. Sarah Walter did last summer. That's available at a PDF online on the Tucker Center website. So if this is something you're of interest in and you want to dig down into the research, please check out that report on tuckercenter.org. Okay, so the sport media guide research was early in your career. Then you got into this idea of refuting or challenging or proving true the narrative that we often heard that sex sells women's sport. So tell us about your light bulb moment around this research project, and then we'll get into what you did and what you found. So why do the study on does sex sell women's sport? What was the impetus?
Well, again, early and mid-career, as I was developing a reputation as a sport media scholar, I would share with various audiences how female athletes were typically portrayed in the media, ranging from on-court competence, which wasn't very often, to off-court sexy babe, and in some cases to sort of images of soft porn. And I would go all over the country before audiences that were sometimes supportive, sometimes not so supportive, or just neutral, or just open to whatever it is I had to say. And inevitably, at the end of every one of my presentations, one of the very first questions that I would get, again, whether or not the audience was supportive or not, was, well, Dr. Kane, I understand your point, and I either agree or I don't agree with your argument. But at the end of the day, frankly, your argument doesn't matter because, as we all know, sex sells women's sports. And so if you want to increase interest in, if you want to put fans in the seats, what you have to do is sexualize female athletes. And it was always the showstopper. And it drove me crazy because, you know, I felt like, I can read an audience pretty well. And I showed them I gave them my best stuff. And I thought I had them. Like, this is an outrage. This is an outrage. And yet when somebody would ask that question, even those who most supported me would nod and say, yeah, what are you going to do? You know, sex sells. I mean, what are you going to do? And again, this wasn't some notion of some male conspiracy, because oftentimes the people who most believed that sex sells, well-meaning, I might add, were sports information directors whose job it was to get fans to come to the games. So I remember driving home one day after about the 800th talk of, yeah, but Dr. Kane, whether you like it or not, sex sells. And I remembered thinking, how do we know that? Because I know the research, and I know of not any study in the country that's ever been done where people have had an opportunity to see female athletes as sexy babes, and then the next season see female athletes at the same school as portrayed as highly competent, and then compared attendance ratings and corporate sponsorship and media coverage. I know that nobody had ever done that kind of study. And when I would talk to those very same sports information directors and say, how do you know that sex sells? Do you have any, have you done any feasibility studies on this? I mean, how do you know that? Where are your data to support your belief and your practice? And they didn't.
That's your showstopper question.
Yeah, and they didn't have any data.
Right.
And so I thought, well, we have to design a study that empirically investigates the question, does sex sell women's sports? And that was easier said than done, because I knew that whatever we found would be publishable. But I also knew that because nobody had ever done anything like this, certainly methodologically, we had to be so rigorous that our results would be credible. And so it took me a long time, almost a year actually, to sort of brainstorm in my head, okay, how are we going to empirically investigate the question, does sex sell women's sports? Maybe it did and maybe it didn't, but the point is nobody had ever done a study to address that question.
And that was almost 10 plus years ago now that you did the first study with a former doctoral student of yours, Heather Maxwell, where you did focus groups of different, both men and women, different ages, and you showed them images in randomized orders from athletic competence to soft porn, and asked them what critical questions.
Well, again, for all of you scholars out there or budding scholars, what I always go back to is, what's the question? And in this particular case, the question was, does sex sell women's sports? So what I wanted to do, or what Dr. Maxwell and I wanted to do, was first of all to take images, not that she and I made up, but that were actually out there in the media in terms of different categories of representation that were exemplars of how female athletes were portrayed, as you just mentioned, Dr. Lavoie, from off-court sexy babe soft porn to images of female athletes on court in action. The other thing we were interested in is, okay, does sex sell women's sports? So who are the people that we're interested in targeting, meaning potential fans? So we had two different age categories, the sweet spot for marketers, which is 18 to 34, and
men.
And men and women, and then another age group, sort of the dads with daughters and moms with daughters demographics, meaning 35 to 55. So we had two different age groups. We had obviously male and female. And then the other thing we were interested in is, in terms of what the viewer or the potential sports fan was going to bring to the image that might influence his or her interpretation of the image, and that was their sports background, whether it was high or low. And then we had three phases to our protocol, and we had four different what are called dependent variables, meaning different ways that people consume women's sports or men's sports too. I didn't want everything to rely on just one single data point. So we had three different phases in our focus group protocol. The first phase, as you pointed out, was to show these exemplar images randomly to these different focus groups. And phase one was just, and we didn't tell them what we were doing, obviously, because we wanted to not bias their interpretations. And so we said, we're just going to show you.
Focus group tip number one. not bias the group.
Right. Or research in general, don't bias the group. So we said, we're going to just show you some images of female athletes. And the first thing we want you to do, don't talk to your neighbors, is just write down on a piece of paper the 2 to 3 words that just free associate pop into your head in terms of how you feel about these images. And then, so we had basically frequency data on phase one. Then in phase two, I wanted to get more quantitative data. And again, we randomized the images again and said, now again, don't talk to your neighbor, but on a scale of 1 to 7, 1 meaning least makes you least interested to 7 makes you most interested, when you see these images, how do they make you feel about reading about women's sports, watching women's sports, attending a sporting event, and buying a season ticket? And then phase three was to have people get in a circle in the focus group and ask them to go around the room and share their responses to phase one and phase two. And in that sense, we had frequency data, we had continuous data where we could get mean scores, and then we had qualitative data where we had probes. And it was extraordinarily interesting in terms of what we found. And I don't know if you want me to go there.
Yeah, I do, because this study really was the first of its kind, and it got the attention not only of our colleagues in sociology and sport media, but also the media themselves. So I think it's important to share the key findings in this study, and then we'll talk about the follow-up studies after we summarize this one, because this was the key one. So what did we find?
Well, what we found was that both female age groups were deeply offended by the sexualized images and the off-court sexy babes images. And they consistently ranked the competence image by far as their number one image. And the same was true with the older male group, the 35 to 55 year old males, or the sort of dads with demographics, that they too gave competence their highest ratings and were offended by the images that were sexualized in terms of female athletes, because as many of the older men said, I would never want to have my daughter portrayed like this. Now, interestingly, and I guess on some level not surprisingly, the 18 to 34 year old males did rank the sexy babe off-court images higher than any of the other focus groups, but at the same time, they still gave competence their highest overall ratings. So they did both. And when we asked them, when we probed in the qualitative phase to say, okay, why did you pick this sort of sexy babe image? And they say, well, because, you know, Danica Patrick looks hot, or Serena Williams is really hot in that kind of skimpy little, you know, tennis outfit. But then when we said to them, and would that kind of image make you go and want to watch women's sports or go to a game or something? And they said, well, no, because that's not what they look like. That's not what Danica Patrick looks like when she's driving a race car. So what we concluded was that younger males in particular were interested in consuming those images of female athletes, but consuming their bodies as objects of sexual desire, not any interest in terms of supporting women's sports. And at the same time, what we found was that both age groups of women and the older dads with demographics, dads with daughters demographics, not only preferred the competence images by a country mile, but they were also deeply offended by the sexualized images. And so the arguments that we then started to make, again, to all the key decision makers, the gatekeepers, meaning sports editors, publishers of newspapers and radios, were selling sex does not only increase interest, it's actually counterproductive.
I think that was the key finding for me too, when I think of what was the key takeaway, is that the key demographic that sport marketers are going for, these young men, the high sport consumers, and we're selling them sex, but selling them sex doesn't mean that they're going to be a sustainable sport fan or a sport consumer. And then you're, when you also do that, you're running the risk of really offending your core sport fan. And so it just seemed counterintuitive that we'd never had this data before, and that a lot of the best practices in sport marketing are based on faulty logic.
Right. And we finally, what's important, and this is, you know, where you take pride in being a scholar and an educator, is that now when people say, but Dr. Kane, sex sells women's sports, I can say, and I do say, not according to the data, it doesn't. Now, having said that, we need many more studies that follow up on the research that Dr. Maxwell and I did. I think one of the reasons why people have not is because it's frankly a pain in the butt to do that kind of research. It's very labor intensive. It's really hard to get study participants to come. Then you have to transcribe all those focus groups, and then you have to come up with some sort of commonality across what it is that they're saying. But I certainly would encourage, again, for all of you budding scholars out there or young assistant professors, replicate our research, because it really needs to be done.
Completely agree. I was here during that time, and I saw how labor intensive it was. And I thought, oh, that's a lot of work for one study. But it certainly was a groundbreaking study. And I think the key sort of soundbite that you got from the study was, you want to say it?
Yeah, sex sells sex, not women's sports.
Okay, you heard it here on Tucker Center Talks. That's a good one. That's a sticky idea, and it's evidence-based, which is always important. It's not just our opinion, but it does need replication. Okay, so we're coming into the home stretch here. After that study, then we did another study, you and I and Dr. Janet Fink at UMass Amherst in the sport management school there. And we did focus groups with collegiate female athletes, basically with the same methodology. So tell the listeners what we found from that study.
Well, again, in terms of a follow-up study, it occurred to me that one group who had never actually been asked how they would like to be portrayed were elite female athletes themselves. I would love to have asked, either then or now as a follow-up, professional female athletes, but they're just impossible to get to. So we defined elite female athletes as Division I scholarship athletes. And because again, you know, you would, the other thing that I would hear a lot is, well, but, you know, don't blame us, meaning from marketers. Female athletes want to be portrayed that way. Nobody put a gun to their head. Nobody put a gun to Danica Patrick's head and made her, you know, do GoDaddy commercials. Nobody forced Serena Williams to be pretty in pink, which is true. That's a whole other analysis. But what I was interested in is, if female athletes were given a choice, how would they prefer to be portrayed? And again, we wanted to compare females in individual versus team sports, because whenever you're doing research, you want to think about, well, what are those external or extraneous variables that may impact your results that you need to pay attention to or control for, which is what we say in the biz. And so I thought, and as did you and Janet Fink, there may be a difference between how female athletes in individual versus team sports wanted to be portrayed. And the reason for that is because, you know, the issue of homophobia and discrimination and bigotry has long been associated with females who play team sports versus individual sports. And that goes back to the notion advanced many, many, many years ago in a classic theory advanced by Eleanor Matheny, who said, as long as you're engaged in a sport that does not require you to challenge traditional notions of femininity and sugar and spice, meaning individual sports like tennis and golf and swimming, you can be a golfer as a female and not challenge traditional stereotypes of what it means to be female. However, if you play softball or you play hockey, or even in some cases basketball, you may do so. So we wanted to see if there was a difference between females engaged in team versus individual sports. And then what we asked them was the following. So rather than do it as a focus group, we brought the females in one-on-one, both here at the University of Minnesota and at the University of Connecticut, which is at the time where Dr. Fink was. And we put these images similar to what we had done in the previous study, and we randomly randomized the order in which they were represented to these young women. Again, we did not tell the women why we were doing the study, but we put these images in front of them in randomized order, and then we asked them four questions. Which one of these images before you best represents A, how you would like to be portrayed, B, how you would like for your sport to be portrayed, C, which one of these images would best increase interest in your sports, and D, which one of these images would best increase respect for your sport? And then, because again, nobody had ever done this study, you just roll the dice and see what happens. And amazingly, and this is one of the most interesting things, at least Dr. Lavoie, you can say how you feel, but of all the studies that I had conducted over 35 years of being in the academy, this was certainly for me the most unexpected result, and yet at the same time the most interesting result, and that is the following. 18 of the 36 young women representing six sports, three team and three individual, said to the person who was asking them which one of these sports best represents you, half of them said, can I pick two? And fortunately, the people who were collecting the data didn't say, no, you can only pick one. I mean, that was a guardian angel moment for me, because you don't want to burn through study participants. And they said, yes, you can pick two. Now tell me why. And what they picked was, all of them picked, when they said, can I pick two? All of them picked the competence image. But then they picked an image that was kind of an all-American girl next door or classy babe image. And when we asked them why they wanted to pick two, they said, because we don't want to be seen as just a sweaty jock. We want to be seen as well-rounded. We're proud of being an athlete, but we also are more than just an athlete. Now, interestingly, and this is exactly why you want to look at team versus individual sports, the vast majority of young women who said, can I pick two, were in team sports. And they didn't really come out and say it, but what was implied was, we have an image problem, and we don't want people to think we're too butch or too masculine. And so even if we don't particularly like it, we're very conscious of our image. And so, yes, we want to be great athletes, but we also want to be seen as ladies and feminine.
Yeah, that finding of can we pick two, and I conducted some of those interviews, and I remember the first time one of the athletes said it, and I did sort of freeze and thought, well, that's not really in the protocol. What do I do? And I just followed my gut and said, yes, pick two. That's okay. We'll figure it out.
Follow the data trail. Always follow the data.
Follow the data. And so we did. And that study was interesting because it built on some of the work by Vicky Crane and her team at Bowling Green about looking at social identity theory and how elite female athletes construct multiple identities in spaces that are athletic. And I think that those two lines of research, ours and Dr. Crane's team, really, again, provide more evidence that sex doesn't sell women's sport, and that female athletes are very aware that people think that sex sells sport and that they should portray themselves in sexualized ways because that's what sells, that's what's good for their brand. But they also know that they don't like it, and they sort of implicitly internalize this dominant narrative of sex sells women's sports, even when they don't like it.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to point out that was a really important finding, which is why you always want to ask more than just one question. When you said to them, which one of these images best will increase respect for your sport, the vast majority said competence. But when you said to them, which one of these images, to reinforce your point, Dr. Lavoie, in terms of how they too have internalized these kinds of master narratives in the culture when the question was, which one of these images will best increase interest for your sport? They put their marketing hats on, and some of them have internalized that sex sells women's sports. That said, a number of them were aware of that narrative and resisted it and actually said things like, I know that that's what some people think, but if that's how we sell ourselves, we are doomed because we will never be taken seriously as athletes. And again, what would be interesting is that study was done in, what, 2016-ish?
Yeah, roughly.
15, 16. We need a replication, ladies and gentlemen out there, because as women's sports have become increasingly accepted, and as the society has gone through an enormous cultural shift in terms of accepting the whole issue of being gay, it might be really interesting. And again, another generation of young women feeling entitled to sports. I predict that you would actually get very different answers, and you wouldn't get a lot of those women saying, "Can I pick two?" But I don't know. And that's the wonderful thing about being a scholar and an educator is let's ask the question and get the answer.
Find the data.
Provide evidence-based research to answer that very important question.
Yeah, you're right. That we might get different results if we replicated that today, because the cultural landscape, it has shifted. It's interesting. So we'll await another research team to replicate those results. I do actually, though, want to end with two key points in terms of our public outreach that has been an outcropping of this line of inquiry in sport media. One is the Here's Proof campaign.
Yes.
So the hashtag Here's Proof that we started in the Tucker Center as a way to change the narrative that no one's interested in women's sports. Because we know people are. And so you and I would be sitting in a stadium somewhere, let's say the Minnesota Lynx playoffs, WNBA championship run, and it's sold out, or the U.S.-Canadian ice hockey rivalry in the Excel Center pre-Olympics, sold out, go for volleyball, sold out, and people would say, "Well, no one's interested in women's sport." And I would take a picture, and then I just like, this is proof of interest. And so those of you that are listening, if you have data, viewership numbers, attendance records, last night I watched the South Carolina women's basketball team beat UConn. They had 18,000 fans in their arena, the highest attendance record this year. That's a perfect example of Here's Proof. So if you have a picture, data, evidence, anything that shows that people are interested in women's sports around the globe, tweet it, hashtag it, Facebook it, Instagram it, and use the hashtag Here's Proof. I really think we need more people to help change this narrative of interest in women's sport.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most important things the Tucker Center has ever done. And kudos to you and the graduate students for coming up with that, because it is a way for us to provide, again, evidence-based proof that women and men are deeply interested and care about women's sports. And they show that in multiple ways, and one of which is being one of those 18,000 people that's at UConn last night.
Yeah, that was really amazing to see the pictures of that on TV, on ESPN2. In prime time.
Precisely.
It matters. Okay. And the second thing I want to alert our listeners to is our documentary called Media Coverage and Female Athletes that came out in 2016 already?
14, 15, somewhere in there.
Which won the Best Sports Documentary Regional Emmy Award here. And the actual Emmy Award is sitting in Dr. Kane's office. I can see it on my screen here, and it's shining in the background, and it does exist. So it's pretty cool. So check that out online. It's streaming free of charge on TPT Minnesota. And a lot of people are using that documentary in their teaching, their scholarship, and to create awareness around this idea that people are interested in women's sport and media portrayals matter. Okay, so let's bring it home, Professor Kane. for our listeners out there, we're going to model your key strategy here of what are three key takeaways from our sport media research over the three decades of your career. What do the three things that we need to know, if nothing else?
That as we approach the 50th anniversary of Title IX in 2022, and by the way, speaking of women's basketball, the Final Four will be hosted by the University of Minnesota in 2022.
You're all invited.
Yep, you're all invited.
Tours of the Tucker Center will be available.
Yep. And that is that what Title IX did is, after decades of being told that young girls and women aren't interested in playing sports, and if they did, they wouldn't be any good when they tried, what we did with Title IX is build them a ballpark and a playing field and an ice rink, and women came in overwhelming numbers. So as I said earlier, the traditional ubiquitous mainstream sports media really does need to start reflecting the reality of how many females play sports up and down the food chain. So the first one is amount of coverage. Let's take it more seriously. I think the second takeaway is that, and I know it's still out there, but sex does not sell women's sports. Sex sells sex. And in fact, it is absolutely counterproductive if your goal is to increase interest in and respect for women's sports. If your goal is to suppress knowledge of and interest in how fabulous female athletes and women's sports really are, then sex indeed does suppress women's sports. Hadn't just thought of that until just now.
That's a good one. I know. I was wondering where you're going with that. You heard it here first, Tucker Center Talks.
Sex suppresses women's sports. Yay, team. She's got another soundbite.
Soundbite alert.
I think the third key takeaway is, and this is, I know I'm sounding like a homer here, but why not? So much of what we've done in the Tucker Center, not just my research, but the work that you, Dr. Lavoie, have done on not just media images, but the whole issue of the unprecedented decline in the number of women coaching in the wake of Title IX, which I'm assuming will be a podcast at some other point.
Yes, stay tuned, listeners.
So much of what we have done in the Tucker Center at the University of Minnesota, we have been able to provide evidence-based research to key decision makers so that we really can advance the cause of providing opportunities and interest in and respect for women's sports. And that's a nice way to spend your day in the office.
I couldn't agree more. And it sure makes coming to the office fun, engaging, not only with each other, but with our students and the vast array of visiting scholars and affiliated scholars and scholars around the world that come and help us construct this body of knowledge that helps make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport. So thank you, Professor Kane, for coming on your second installment of Tucker Center Talks. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
I'm Megan Kahn, host of the We Coach podcast. Every 2 weeks, I chat with female coaches, administrators, or industry experts from a variety of sports across the country. Be sure to tune in every other Thursday on your favorite podcast player for inspiring conversations. I'll see you there.
As we conclude this episode of Tucker Center Talks, send us your proof of interest in women's sport and use the hashtag #HeresProof. We'd love to hear from you via Twitter at Tucker Center, or you can tweet me directly at Dr. Sports Psych. Be sure to check out our website at tuckercenter.org. Follow us on Facebook or Instagram. You can find us on digital media if you want to. You can find the show notes with links and resources for this episode at wispsports.com. Be sure to look for the Tucker Center Talks under the Listen tab, where you'll find a lot more conversations from around the world about women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport.